Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. I was just reflecting on when I started practice in Ubon. The way I made effort in my lay life, if I wanted to make strong effort, I was very fierce. So if I played sport, I would get kind of really angry. Or if I was studying, which I didn't do that well, but if I finally knuckled down to my books, I would do it through a kind of fierceness and an anger. And I could get results, but I was miserable to live with. So I could play football or basketball or something and then get really, really fierce and play. I wasn't very good, but I could play above my usual standard. Of course, no one liked me then. So I thought socially it was a real disaster. But it was a way that I had conditioned myself to make strong effort. So when I went to the monastery, that's what I knew. That's what I had done before. So when teacher would say make strong effort, I would plug into that old pattern. That's what I did. That's how you make strong effort. And I would try to attain to something or accomplish something or get rid of something, whatever I was trying to do. And of course, the result was a disaster. And even though Lompo Cha would say, just relax, Lompo Sumedho would say, just relax, I'd say, yeah, but I'm tough. And so other people could see my delusion, and other people could see the problem, and other people could say what the solution was, but I had to run into my own brick walls, make my own mistakes. But always the teachers were there to sort of pick me up and say, keep going, keep trying, keep learning. And so little by little through just, especially in the beginning, extreme wrong effort, very extreme wrong effort. But in it there was a sincerity, there was a determination to somehow learn. And there was the inspiration of my teachers and whatever comes from before all that. And so I'm reminded of that lovely Thai phrase, Pit Pan Kru, that mistake is teacher. And it's true, isn't it? That quite often we can see each other's tendencies which might not be giving good results. And yet we can't see our own tendencies in that way. So the requirement is to, you just have to do it a lot, you have to endure, you have to tough it out, you can't give up, really. And also on a social level, it's very important to be tolerant and forgiving of people's difficulties that we have. So even if we're making effort from a more wise place, even then we still have like the forces of karma coming up. So I was just talking with Venerable Khema about the hindrance of sleepiness and how when we read that biography of Lompa Li, I mean, no worries, we read that the day before, was it? The day before that extreme realization that he had, he hit a wall of sleepiness. Just like walk to the end of the walking path, he'd fall down. And this is like, and the day before he's got this extreme piti, an extreme happiness, extreme peace, which is inexplicable. So even with right understanding and right effort, we're faced with sometimes strong karmic forces that sometimes we understand, sometimes we don't understand. So there is this necessity just to take what comes and just keep applying attention to it until you either figure it out or you just endure it until it ceases. You understand where wrong effort is. And so the ideas around developing parami are very helpful. So when I think of my fierce youthful stage of practice, I didn't really understand how to develop parami. I didn't understand like how to make a determination and then use a determination to look at my mind and to develop good qualities. So let's say I was on the exercise machine just now and just watching how determination works, where I said, okay, I'm gonna do this exercise for a certain amount of time, and then 10 minutes into that exercise cycle, my mind says, enough already. But the adhitana is saying, no, stick with it. And then the mindfulness, oh, this is wanting to quit. This is wanting to stop. This is what it feels like. This is the feeling of wanting to stop. But I don't stop. Why? Because I set up a determination to keep going. But the determination is not to become someone who achieves something, although that's there. But the primary thing in contemplative practice is to use the determination to observe what happens to the mind within that determination. So the primary thing is not the accomplishment of a period of exercise, but it's to watch the citta, to watch not wanting to carry on, wanting to stop, wanting to do less, or thinking, oh, I'm really doing well now, I'm really going well now, and then not wanting, just talking about the way the mind is moving. So the determination helps to be more mindful, just more mindful, more aware. And also develops the skill of sticking with something, being with something, but it's never from bhava tanha. It's never from bhava tanha. And this is that was my big mistake, was my adhitanas were from bhava tanha. And we see in the text, we see the cessation of bhava, the cessation of becoming, constantly that we find that, the cessation of becoming. So to make effort without trying to go somewhere, this is rather foreign territory often, because just the very definition for us sometimes is, well, to make effort, I want to get something in the future. I want to attain to something or get rid of something now. And that very sense of bhava, me, being someone going somewhere, is a form of avijja or ignorance. It's a form of self-personality view. But to come to a kind of contrary conclusion, to think, well, any kind of effort then is self, any kind of effort is self-view, any kind of effort is bhava, will paralyze you. I know I went through that kind of doubting phrase, well, anything I do then, anything I do is not going to work. Because it's self. I can't do anything. And that's just doubt, really. Just doubt. So, if we observe, like, in the mind, the why we make effort, and we observe the craving behind it, and let go of the craving, and yet be determined. So I have a determination to say, just do that exercise cycle for an hour or so. And then within that, I don't have to do it with desire, I can just do it with determination. It doesn't have to be a me becoming something. It doesn't have to be a sense of self becoming something. It can just be the application of effort to see what happens. What happens if I do this for an hour? What's going to be that? Same thing like when we have a program of meditation. What happens in the hour of meditation? And all of us make an adhitana to be here, don't we? Even though it's maybe not explicit, just by the fact that we come to the room, we know we stay with the clock and so on, we make a kind of underlying adhitana, oh, I'm going to stick this out. And then in that sticking it out, you feel bored with it, or you get pain, you get restless, start thinking about something else. And so the container of the determination for 1 hour or 45 minutes is very helpful, isn't it? Helps us to look at things we might not normally look at. And this is a good thing. This is a very good thing. One of the things I think I did learn, I learned a lot in Ubon, but sometimes the monks would talk about training with Dukkha Vedana. How would you say that? Dukkha Vedana? Anyway, that we have, you know, as human beings, we have both Sukha and Dukkha Vedana, both pleasant and unpleasant experiences, feelings within those experiences. And to actually train with Dukkha Vedana is a kind of foreign idea to a society which is based on pleasure, which is based on maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain. And to train with Dukkha Vedana, to train with unpleasant, can sound like Atakilimatana Yoga. It can sound like self-mortification to train with Dukkha Vedana. But actually, that we do a lot of that when we sit. You know, like, especially the beginning of a retreat, you know, people feel, you know, restless or dull or bored, you know, the mind's not so bright, and that's very unpleasant, actually. Dullness is very unpleasant, not nice. The pain in the body is very, very unpleasant. And to train with Dukkha Vedana is to, and how to train with Dukkha Vedana is to, I think the ideas of Parami are very, very helpful. Because if you can put that attitude into your jitta as you're sitting through an hour, and you're feeling like nothing's working, say, well, and you say, well, I'm just going to be patient with the feeling of nothing working. I'm going to try to just develop the parami of determination and patience. And just that statement to yourself is very, very helpful. Very, very helpful. If you have enough and mindfulness and enough presence and enough objectivity to actually say that to yourself. Okay, it's difficult sitting. Yeah, it's difficult sitting, but I'm just going to try to stay with it, stay with the unpleasantness of it, just for the sake of training with the unpleasant, just for the sake of being patiently unpleasant, just for the sake of being mindful of the unpleasant. Which isn't to say you hurt yourself, but if that's what's coming up with a sitting, okay, this feeling of whatever it is unpleasant. As opposed to trying to become someone who has a pleasant experience, and hence trying to get rid of the unpleasant experience. That's the force of craving, isn't it? The craving to get the pleasant and get rid of the unpleasant, which is bhava, vibhava, and tanha. To train to kind of develop character through the paramitas, through metta, it all belongs. What I was saying, you know, this morning, how on a retreat we really have a really lovely opportunity to look at stream of consciousness, because our social activity is so minimal, the complexity of the problems we face are very minimal for the bhikkhus, for the lay crew. It's a bit more complicated. It's not so complicated. So it's much, much easier just to watch feeling as feeling, annoyance as annoyance, or excitement as excitement. They're just kind of simple things like that, rather than the complexity of a complex social situation. And then to see that to kind of develop this metta attitude to the whole stream of consciousness. As I was saying to my mind, it all belongs. What does that do to your mind? That kind of reflection, it all belongs. Or like I like to put it, non-resistance, it all belongs. So the flow of consciousness can have all manner of things coming through it. Social life can have all manner of things in it. Nothing is right or wrong. It just is as it is. Our karma is what it is. And just to constantly come to that metta attitude, to that attitude of openness and largeness and acceptance and non-conflict and non-resistance, you know, bringing all that language to this flow of life as we experience it in these different ways. Dullness or pain or brightness and inspiration. So it's obviously easy to be with inspiration. That doesn't take much effort to practice when you feel inspired, and good. We need inspiration. I wouldn't deny its usefulness. But When we don't feel inspired, we feel ho-hum, another day, another chanting, and so on. What happens to the mind when it doesn't have that kind of gift of inspiration? Well, it's still stuff, you know, it's still the flow of consciousness. It all belongs. And the more we can make our mind open and vast like that, the more we find that there is a silence and peace within the turbid waters of our karma. So that's one, that's that. So do look very carefully at the tendency to resist or try to get something other than it is, that's here, to try to get inspired or try to manufacture metta as a kind of emotional quality. So metta on that level is like even disliking someone belongs. It's part of being human. And then the other, none of it is worth it. Nothing is worth grasping. Nothing is worth believing in. Nothing is worth attaching to. And that's the renunciation of this attachment to all the movement. And between those two, you could see one is allowing and the other is not grasping. And both are not grasping in a way. But one is allowing. So they say it's like the perfect hostess or host who allows all conditions to come, but then lets all conditions go. That's the sort of imagery that we have. So we watch as these different guests come into consciousness. Rumi has a beautiful poem on that. I can't remember it. But, you know, these different guests coming to dinner, and some are sloppy and some are neat, and some throw the chicken bones over your shoulder, and some use a knife and fork, and some clean the dishes and some don't clean the dishes, but they're all part of the banquet, they're all coming and going. And trying to see that sense of both tolerance and openness and acceptance, it all belongs, and yet not grabbing any of it, not grasping any of it, not holding on to any of it. It's quite a task to do. And where we get preoccupied with the khandhas in any way, that's what we have to look at. Why is my mind obsessed around this? Or why do I keep going back to that particular mood? Or how is this particular mood? Why do I get kind of caught with it? Or whatever it might be. And the kind of balance point of all this is this capacity to really taste the present moment. Pure presence, just kind of really, really tasting the moment, listening to the moment, keep returning to that quality you're really attentive to what is. And it's amazing how that is the simplest thing, because there only is what is, as it were, how we can forget that, how we can be gone into the future, into whatever we thinking about the future, or struggling with some past event, and actually just that moving back and forth and not taking that intersection of the timeless as time as the place to be always, because that's the only place you can be. So just tasting each moment that way, this way. Learning to hold attention in the present moment in that way, which is not becoming. You know, when I just listen to this moment or feel the pain in my leg, or just know, oh yeah, boredom is this kind of emotion, and I really just say, let it be fully conscious, then that's pure presence. That's awareness of the way things are. Right? And if I keep returning to that, then I'll see the tendency to try to become something else, try to get rid of this one. Well, see tanha. I'll begin to see tanha. I'll be see craving. And it's the abandonment of craving. It's the abandonment of greed, hatred, and delusion, or forms of craving, that the vanishing of that, the cessation of that, is from that Samyutta reading, that is the unconditioned, that is the island, that is the peace. And that's always here and now. You know, that can never be in the future. So if I think peace lies in the future, then I'm still looking for some kind of a condition. But the peace of that the Buddha is pointing to is not a conditioned peace in the same way that, like coming from the Bhikkhu Vihara, the long walk I have now, very arduous to here, and the beautiful silence, right? And the almost full moon, and a crisp coolness of a January Canadian day, just beautiful, serene, and silent. But that's still a condition. That's a natural condition, but it's still conditioned. Whereas what the abandonment of or cessation of greed, hatred, delusion is pointing to something different. It's something that is can be in the middle of Bangkok, or can be in the midst of a mood of the mind, and it's still very silent, very still. So sometimes we mistake conditioned peace for the peace that the Buddha's pointing to. And then when we mistake conditioned peace for that, then we remember that conditioned peace, then we try to repeat that conditioned peace, and then we're in conflict with the way things are. But the way things are the way things are, and the peace that we're pointing to is not, it's not like the taste of a situation, but that which knows and doesn't grasp the situation. So any situation is valid. Any situation has that potential. So like Ajahn Chah, when we were in Hampstead Vihara, and he, that story you hear, we're meditating in this shrine room, and it's very, very noisy. Very noisy. Very, very noisy. Traffic and people drunk outside and in Hampstead Vihara. And Lompo Cha says, you know, you people go out there and bother the noise. Stop bothering the noise. And that's that same idea where Lompo Dun says, when the mind is sent out, that's the origin of suffering. And the call, and the result is suffering. And then when the mind knows the mind, that's the path. And the result is the cessation of suffering. Just the mind knowing the mind. So just that knowing constantly, again and again and again, whatever it's doing. And then introducing the idea of parami around dukkha vedana. So if you're experiencing any dukkha vedana, can you wake up? Oh, this is unpleasant. And now's the chance just to abide with the unpleasant. Be patient with the unpleasant. Kind of put in an attitude of mind which is very wholesome, very skillful, rather than the tendency to always strive, try to get the pleasant states of mind. On a retreat, the first few days are difficult, to say the least. Usually they're kind of like purification or stuff coming up, or that's why I like to do a kind of structured retreat in the beginning of a 3-month retreat. I think it's helpful. I don't know about you, but it just kind of gets us going into the mode of sitting, walking, sitting, walking, sitting, walking. So I would really encourage you to continue doing that. And you know, there's a temptation then to distract and do things which are not part of our duty schedule, but try not to follow those temptations. If you're going to read Dhamma material which inspires and helps you to reflect. You know, if you're going to read something that really enriches your day in terms of reflection, that's very, very useful. Whether it's a sutta or it's whatever teacher, something that helps you to constantly be looking at things in terms of Dhamma is very helpful. But be careful not to take boredom and restlessness and just fill up the mind because it's bored and restless, because that'll make you more restless and that'll create more boredom. So have the determination to allow the mind to feel what it feels rather than seeking a compensation if it's unpleasant. Because when we have dukkha vedana, then of course we seek some kind of compensation, some kind of distraction to fill up that void, to fill up that sense of lack. And it's that very sense of lack that if we abide with it and we don't if we don't react to it with craving, with tanha, the tanha ceases. So whenever we feel a sense of lack or a sense of wanting something else, then that's when that vedana brings forth tanha, doesn't it? That brings forth craving. And it's that very moment that requires the kanti parami, which requires adhitana parami, which requires panya parami, to know this is tanha which has arisen. And to endure that, to bear witness to it, then in the ceasing, you start to approach that sutta, the ceasing of greed, the ceasing of hatred, the ceasing of delusion is the unconditioned. Yeah? The vanishing of these is the island, is the final aim. So the sense of lack that we feel, or the sense of not rightness or not getting anywhere, whatever way you want to put that, dukkha, is actually very, very important, very important. And oftentimes the peace of the mind, the prelude to the peace of the mind, is some rotten state of mind. It's a boredom, or you know, it's like the overture to the symphony of peace is a garbage pit. You know, you get some garbage coming up, some, you know, ugly states of mind or restlessness and everything in your desire mind. I don't want this. I want to do something. I don't look at this. And then, no, I'm going to stay with this. And what happens is then the attention now isn't seeking a compensation, staying with tanha, and then the tanha ceases and your mind's peaceful. And you think, oh, how did I do that? And then you try to produce it, and you have tanha again. But oftentimes that's the case, is where you allow something to become conscious. You let it come up into the mind, and you have enough insight to see this is changing. This is important. Be patient with it. And it runs its course, and you realize the cessation, and then the craving has ceased. And you have a kind of peacefulness there which is not dependent on running away. Whereas if you run away, or you seek a compensation around those things, then of course you just repeat the cycle. So you might get some kind of short-lived happiness from getting a distraction, but then as soon as that happiness goes, of course you're in the cycle of, oh, there it is again. Oh no, right? Well, what if you stick with it? You stick with it, okay. You have the kind of courage and resolution to stick with it, and you see it as anicca dukkha anatta, then the craving is ceasing. The craving is ceasing. That's an arduous process, and it requires, you know, courage and wisdom and intelligence and determination, all these character traits that we develop in our way. So this is the idea of training with dukkha vedana. Whereas before, when I was a younger fellow, my training with dukkha vedana was conquering. You know, I'm just going to conquer. It's like monk against walking path. I'm going to really practice. And of course, it was all full with ego and unskillful states of mind. But such is the nature of avijja. You know, avijja's that way. And when we look back at avijja, we think, well, gee, was I really that stupid? But we don't see. It's not that you're so stupid, you just don't see when it's driven by these things. It's kind of like my mother when she was about 90-ish, her hearing in one ear was bad already, and then on the other ear went. So then we called the doctor. Fortunately, the doctor would come, and the doctor looked in her ear with these ear flashlights that they have, and oh, wax in the ear. And then she came the next time and had this massive syringe and put oil in mom's ear, and then pumping this ear out like it's a toilet bowl or something, you know. Mom's, oh, no, it's not working. Came back a second time. Got to get that wax out. Oh, can't get it out. Okay, have to go to a specialist. Go to Civic Hospital. Take a taxi. Get mom dressed. it's a real to-do to get her out of the house. Get to the doctor, see the specialist. He looks in her ear, he says, no wax. There was no wax in her ear. Wrong view. He says, lady, you need a hearing aid. So we got a hearing aid. And Avijja's that way. You know, you kind of, you think you understand and you follow these passions or viewpoints or energies or whatever, and it's like there's no wax, actually. You're looking in the wrong place. And the ultimate Avijja is looking for, you know, looking for happiness in the khandhas, looking for the permanent and that which is impermanent, looking for the deathless and that which is bound by birth and death. So the kind of infatuation with the khandhas, or the pull towards the khandhas, or thinking that happiness is or the peace of liberation lies in the future time, that's like thinking there's wax in the ear. It's not there. You're looking in the wrong place. You've got the wrong viewpoint. Or it's like the red chili that, who was the Sufi?
Nasruddin.
Nasruddin's eating, you know, he's sitting by a spice shop and he's eating these chilies and he's crying. And someone asks him, why are you eating all those chilies? You're crying, Nasruddin. He says, oh, I'm looking for a sweet one. It's the same way, the khandhas are that way. They're, you know, that's what craving is doing. It's kind of saying, over here, come here, come here. And it's like a red herring. It's the wrong place of looking. And the right place of looking is, this is the way it is now. Which is not in time, it's not future, it's always here, 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 here. And to trust in that is hard when there's dukkha vedana. When there's dukkha vedana, then the sirens are saying, no, no, not here, go somewhere else. Find something else, find a compensation. And the trouble with that is it does work to a certain extent. You can find compensations for your suffering which work to a certain extent. Then you need another one. You need another one. So to train with dukkha vedana is to just know, oh, this is just the khandhas. They have arisen, they stay for a while and they cease. Not to hurt yourself, I'm not saying to hurt yourself, but just in the natural course of events, much of our khandha experience has dukkha veda in it. You know, it has the unpleasant in it, it's just part of it. And to know that is to develop upekha barami, develop adhitana barami, to develop panya barami, all those things to develop. And that's a real foundation for now sustaining attention on non-grasping, non-becoming, non-craving. And that sustaining of that for long, long periods of time is the path. All right, I'll leave that for your reflection.
Anandamayam dhammagadaya sadhu karangadamase. Sadhu.